Well, greetings and welcome to the iFormerX podcast, where we explore the evidence that informs ambulatory care pharmacy practice. My name is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormerX. One of the most common problems in ambulatory care practice is treatment-resistant hypertension. Now, in some cases, patients truly need four and sometimes even five medications to get their blood pressure to goal. But in many cases, the underlying problem is related to medication adherence. The difficulty, of course, is figuring out when additional medications or perhaps a dose change are needed, or when to focus our efforts on developing good medication-taking habits and reducing barriers to treatment are needed. A research letter recently published in JAMA Internal Medicine caught my eye because it describes a relatively easy and frequently overlooked strategy to distinguish true treatment resistance from medication adherence problems as the likely cause. And joining me today to talk about this small but elegant study are Megan Brown and Raven Jackson. Dr. Brown is an ambulatory care specialist who practices in a federally qualified community health center in Yazoo City, Mississippi. And she's also one of my colleagues here at the University of Mississippi School of Pharmacy. And Dr. Jackson practices at the Family Doctors Clinic at the West Jefferson Medical Center in Marrero, Louisiana, and is on faculty at Xavier University College of Pharmacy, just down the road in beautiful New Orleans. So Megan, Raven, welcome to the iFormerX podcast.
Thank you for having us, Stuart. I'm excited.
Hi, glad to be here.
So before we get started, I want you to imagine you're seeing RL, a 64-year-old African-American female, in the primary care clinic today for a routine blood pressure follow-up visit. And the patient has a long-standing history of high blood pressure. While RL is also overweight, she's otherwise healthy. She reports no personal history of cardiovascular disease, but states that her older brother has some kidney problems and her father died at age 66 from a stroke. The patient currently takes lisinopril 20 milligrams twice daily, hydrochlorothiazide 25 milligrams daily, amlodipine 10 milligrams daily, and last week she was started on spironolactone 12.5 milligrams once daily. She currently weighs 201 pounds and her BMI is 36.2. Her blood pressure today is 152 over 84, and a Chem-7 was drawn this morning. Her electrolytes were all within normal limits, including her serum potassium, which was 4.1, a serum glucose of 96, a serum creatinine of 1.4. Her estimated GFR is 46 mils per minute. And as you look through her chart, you note that her A1C was 6.2%. And her LDL cholesterol was 96, HDL cholesterol 64, and triglycerides were 188 a few months ago. So before we talk about the study that you reviewed in your commentary, can you tell me a little bit about the things that are going through your mind in a case like this? What additional information might you want to collect and assess during this encounter?
Certainly, Stuart. RL sounds very similar to the patients that I see every day when I'm in Yazoo City. We are certainly concerned about her blood pressure. Her family history has some information that we may need to ask a few more questions about. And of course, she's overweight, which is what we typically see also here in Mississippi. Some things that we would want to consider is just looking at, of course, her adherence. And since the patient's already on four blood pressure medications, we want to take a deep dive into that and make sure that we understand any barriers that exist to ensuring that RL is able to get the medication she needs. And in addition, some of the things that we consider would be her health literacy level, her current job or hobby, as well as her diet and lifestyle, as some of these things aren't mentioned here. Some diet and lifestyle points we certainly want to emphasize with this patient would be salt restriction, losing weight, so approximately 10% of her body weight would be helpful, and then, of course, avoiding over-the-counter NSAIDs.
Stuart, in regards to some of the additional information we might want to collect or assess during this encounter, we also want to collect her social history specifically in regards to smoking and her total cholesterol in order to properly assess her ASCVD risk, as those information points are missing. It may also be helpful to know if the patient is using any over-the-counter medications, as none of those are also mentioned in her medication list. In regards to labs, it might be relevant to collect coronary calcium as well as hsCRP, as these are markers that we know can affect ASCVD risk. Coronary calcium is being used more often as a marker for diseased arteries, and moderate elevations in ASCRP, generally between 1 and 10, is likely indicative of chronic vascular inflammation. And usually an hsCRP greater than 2 is commonly seen as the threshold for ASCVD adjustment, so we would like both of those. Albuminuria as well as sodium levels might also be helpful in regards to just better assessing the patient's kidney function, as her GFR is a little on the low side. Some additional treatment options that we might consider. The patient does have a couple ASCVD major risk factors, including age and high blood pressure. The 10-year ASCVD risk was a little hard to calculate, being that some elements were missing, but it is likely to be greater than 7.5 based on the patient's risk factors. Moderate or high intensity statin might be appropriate based on this patient's ASCVD, as well as the fact that the LDL is between 70 and 189. So, for example, atorvastatin 20 milligrams daily might be a good option. Also, it may be a good option for this patient because there's no dose adjustment for moderate renal dysfunction, which the patient does have.
And looking at her medication list, so being on what's recommended per the guidelines, lisinopril, she's on HCTZ-25 and a calcium channel blocker, amlodipine. She is maxed at all three of those and additionally has been given spironolactone at 12.5 milligrams, which is a decent starting dose. So the addition of the fourth line agent, again, is something that we would typically do and is the appropriate next step in the management of apparent treatment-resistant hypertension. With the 20 milligram lisinopril being dosed twice daily, though it's generally dosed once daily, we are aware that the elimination half-life of lisinopril is only 12 hours, which might explain why the provider decided to go with twice-a-day dosing. Some literature does suggest improved blood pressure control with this frequency, and so we would consider leaving that as a twice-daily medication. Additionally, I have read studies, and we know that taking a blood pressure medication at night is helpful in managing hypertension, just having the ability to lower the blood pressure.
I was just going to speak in regards to the spironolactone 12.5 once daily dosing. As Megan mentioned, that is an effective fourth agent to add on. We do still have some room to increase this agent to maybe 25 milligrams daily, or we can do that as 12.5 milligrams twice daily, specifically about 2 weeks after the initial treatment has started. We may be able to titrate up to even 100 milligrams, but we would want to be cautious of increasing that dose in a patient who does have some level of CKD. We also know the higher dose of spironolactone could also improve the patient's potassium level, which is at a 4.1, still within the normal range, but on the lower end of normal. We want to be mindful of potassium levels, so we want to make sure that that is addressed. And then lastly, we wanted to assess the patient's prediabetes risk, given the A1C of 6.2. We think that a confirmatory test should be conducted either via another A1C or another method of diagnosis to determine if the patient does indeed have prediabetes. Considering the patient's weight and additional risk factors, it is likely in the addition of metformin 500, maybe as a once daily dose, might be an appropriate start for this patient, again, in combination with some diet and lifestyle modifications, specifically around carbohydrates and meal portions.
So, Raven, let's talk about the results of the study you reviewed for iFormerX. The paper was published online in June 2019 in JAMA Internal Medicine and is entitled Use of Directly Observed Therapy to Assess Treatment Adherence in Patients with Apparent Treatment-Resistant Hypertension. Now, for those in our audience who haven't read that paper, and it's a research letter, actually, can you give us a brief summary of the analysis and its major findings?
Sure. So this article looked at non-adherence, again, as it pertains to apparent treatment-resistant hypertension. The study enrolled several patients who had apparent treatment-resistant hypertension to undergo what's known as directly observed therapy, abbreviated as DOT, with blood pressure monitoring in clinic until the medication reached its peak response. There were questions that were given to the patients to assess adherence from a nurse. The primary outcome was to see which proportion of patients would meet the daytime systolic blood pressure goal after DOT and the secondary outcome looked at if that goal was met 1 month post. About 60 participants enrolled in the study, and 48 actually went through and we were able to gather results from. Most patients were men with an average age of 62. BMI on average was 32 with prescription insurance, and there was an average of 4 blood pressure lowering medications for most patients, and comorbidities were most of the normal comorbidities that we see with patients with hypertension, including stroke and diabetes. After directly observed therapy, 14 of the 48 patients, which is about 29% of the population, studied met the daytime mean systolic blood pressure goal of less than 135 millimeters of mercury, and 14 out of 46 patients, that's 30%, met the daytime mean systolic blood pressure goal at 1 month.
So, Megan, obviously this study doesn't have the same rigor as a randomized control blinded study, but given the nature of this problem and the intervention, mainly directly observed treatment, I'm not sure it would be possible to blind such a study. In your opinion, what are the key strengths and limitations of this study?
I agree, Stuart. That would be very difficult. Some strengths of this study design is that selection bias is eliminated, as participants are not generally selected by who might be more or less likely to have the outcome of interest. And so prospective cohort studies such as this one also set up an easy to follow sequence of events between the exposure and the outcome. So in regards to strengths of the study as a whole, I would say that it overall seems easily implementable. I would state that a limitation might be that the fact that the nurse questionnaire was not clearly defined, so we're not really sure the questions that were asked or how they were asked in a non-judgmental manner to ensure that the patient could answer truthfully about their perceived adherence. And the other things that we could think about as it relates to the strengths and limitations of this particular study is that, you know, race is not actually mentioned when they talk about the demographics. And I think that would be important, certainly in our country, as we do see that minorities tend to have a higher risk of resistant hypertension. Also in this study, it was done in Canada, so they have a national healthcare system. And so a lot of the patients had insurance. There were, I believe, maybe 4 that did not have insurance. So that's something to consider, as we often encounter, and certainly working at a federally qualified health center, that's something that I encounter on a daily basis, is dealing with the socioeconomic issues that play into why our patients cannot be adherent or don't have the means to purchase their medication or the treatment that we would like for them. And then in general, representation of men in clinical studies, we know tends to be higher with most of our patients in this study being men. So that's just something to consider as well.
Great. So let's return to the case of RL. What should we do? Do you feel directly observed treatment is worthy of trying in a case like this? And if so, how would you go about implementing it? What are some of the logistical issues that you'd need to consider? And how would you respond to the results?
Thanks, Stuart. That's a really good question. Ideally, the patient should be at goal with being on 4 blood pressure medications. And with that, we want to definitely now consider adherence as being a major problem that we should first address. And that can be addressed in many different ways, either via discussing a pill box or synchronized fills or reminder apps or some type of technology to assist the patient with her medication adherence. Directly observed therapy may be an effective tool for this patient, as it could be a helpful way to rule out if it is truly treatment resistant hypertension. Some logistical issues that we considered would be how it would be implemented, because directly observed therapy can be implemented in many different ways. Some issues that we might come across as we are potentially thinking about DOT is accessibility. We also want to make sure that a pharmacist is able to set up prearranged times that fit both the pharmacist's schedule and the patient's schedule in order to facilitate that directly observed therapy. Thinking more long-term, we want to also consider reimbursement for pharmacy services, being that this is outside of what the normal role of the pharmacist might be, and ways that we can make this happen in generally any clinic setting, as it would expand the role of the pharmacist.
In addition, if the patient's blood pressure responded well to directly observed therapy, this could indicate an issue with adherence, and we could potentially get the patient to goal without changing the therapy, but emphasizing adherence and ways to ensure that the patient has the ability to adhere to the regimen. If the patient's blood pressure does not respond well to the directly observed therapy, we would need to think back on the medications that the patient is on to decide if we need to make changes to the regimen, or even looking at the timing in which the patient is taking the therapy.
So Meg and Raven, I want to thank you both for joining me today to discuss the treatment of hypertension, treatment-resistant hypertension, and the potential role of directly observed treatment. I think it's clear from your comments that you believe there is a role for directly observed treatment, and it can help us sort out between apparent treatment-resistant hypertension and those who truly have treatment-resistant hypertension. Well, tell us what you think. Only iFormerX members can leave comments and use the interactive features on the site. You can become a member of iFormerX. It's free, so sign up today. And good news, if you are a board-certified ambulatory care pharmacist, we're excited to tell you about our partnership with the American Pharmacists Association to offer this commentary and podcast for board recertification credit. To learn more about APHA's Ambulatory Care Board Prep and Recertification Program, click on the link at the bottom of the written commentary posted on the iFormerX website. And lastly, a special thanks to the many volunteers who make iFormerX possible. A big shout out goes to Catherine Katie Kaiser with South College in Knoxville, Tennessee. Katie has been an associate editor of iFormerX for 6 years and has made numerous contributions, recruiting authors, reviewing commentaries, maintaining a resource page, and approving new membership applications. So thank you, Katie. We couldn't do it without you. And until next time, this is Stuart Haynes, editor-in-chief of iFormerX, signing off.